Hello, this is Gerd Leonhardt, futurist, humanist, and author of Technology versus Humanity, in a podcast about my book, Chapter 9, which is called Taking the Happenstance Out of Happiness. So in short, it's a chapter about happiness. And my colleague, Peter Van, who is the curator for the Futures Agency, he is on the other line, and he is going to squeeze out some pretty interesting statements from my brain, I suppose. So hello, Peter.
Hello, Gert. That's right. I'm going to squeeze out some nice statements from you. I think it's good that we start with defining happiness. You did a pretty good job in the book because you defined two types of happiness, hedonic and eudaimonic happiness. I think that's worth some explanation.
Yeah, I mean, basically, of course, it's a huge topic of what happiness is. It's not that easy to define, but ever since I've written the book, I keep fine-tuning this. But basically, superficial happiness is hedonic happiness, which is a temporary happiness, and that is given to us in many different ways, like food or a nice phone call or a nice short conversation, or you know, a short, like a like on Facebook is a kind of a happiness, right? A short 0.5 seconds or so. And then there's eudaimonia, which is of course the Greek word for deep contentment happiness, which is a happiness that you can't create or you can't buy and you can't click somewhere to obtain. That's something that makes you feel like you're content with yourself and you have an ongoing internal happiness, like being satisfied with your life, having realized something, you know, found the purpose of life, whatever that may be. And that sort of general happiness, you know. And lately I've been saying at my speaking gigs, riffing off this idea and saying that happiness, you cannot find happiness in the cloud or on a screen or with an AI, because the happiness is a human thing that's inside of yourself, right? And so in the book I explain why hedonic happiness isn't bad, it's good. But if we just pursue hedonic happiness, we end up jumping from one short fix to the next.
Yeah. And so you open the chapter by making the statement that striving for happiness, and I assume you mean eudaimonic happiness, is an essential component of being human, uniting us all. It's at the center of human flourishing, and at the center of this whole man-machine debate, which is the core of your book.
Yeah, I mean, seeking happiness is very much a human undertaking. It's something that all of us seek happiness in different ways. You know, we may dress it up in different ways, but in the end, we want to be content. We want to feel like we've achieved something. You know, it's basically the needs hierarchy towards self-realization, wisdom, contentment, you know, that sort of angle, and that is really quite different than achieving, you know, free phone calls or lots of downloads on Spotify or so. You know, that's sort of hedonic happiness.
Yeah, I would like to jump on the word wisdom and practical wisdom or practical ethical wisdom. I have seen on your latest blog posts that you seem to be back into a deeper reflection mode on what now really matters. And I like in the book that you mention, and I was surprised that you have been a student of Lutheran theology in back in the early 80s. And so you write very eloquently about the Aristotelian philosophy, especially about virtue and wisdom, or arete and phronesis. I think that's worth some expansion from your side.
Yeah, I mean, I went to the trouble of having to study old ancient Greek and Hebrew and Latin for some bizarre reason. I actually did this in university, even though I wasn't actually religious. That was really as a kid I was, but then later on I was interested in the philosophy part of it, and so I ran across all this. Of course, we had to read all the ancient Greek and translate them to German and so on. It was quite tedious. But the word phronesis is really important, because there's an important part of what is being transferred in this is this idea of saying, you know, we are looking at things in to become wiser, but in a practical way, not in a way of saying that, you know, we have this theoretical construct that, and this was the debate between Plato and Aristotle, right? One was about the sort of higher thinking and, you know, further down the road, and one was about being practical and actually getting stuff done. two entirely different things. Yeah. And so I talk about this a lot in the book. It's really a key term that I've made part of my own work, is to say, yeah, hopefully I can come up with some wisdoms that are not ephemeral in the sense of, you know, only for the very few intellectual high flyers, but but also in a very basic way. So like when I say, you know, that we will not find happiness on the cloud, I hope that is something that gets people to think about practical things.
There is a whole section in this chapter basically revolving around a statement that Robert Kennedy made way back when he was flagging GDP as the wrong metric to measure success. So I think he said it, GDP measures everything except what that which makes life worthwhile. And so in your book, you mention a couple of other ways of measuring what is worthwhile, such as the gross national happiness index and the genuine progress indicator. So let's maybe say something about the gross national happiness index and then the GPI later on.
Yeah, I mean, some people call GDP a grossly distorted product. This is their way of basically measuring something that for most people doesn't really measure anything really important, just economic progress and jobs and relationships of numbers and so on. There have been many attempts. You know, Bhutan had the gross national happiness, which, you know, when I went to Bhutan a couple of years ago, it was quite clear just that sort of thing came out of left field and wasn't really a designed concept, but it became something that a lot of people think of that when they think about Bhutan, you know, what is gross national happiness. And the GPI is much more interesting. I think that's basically this idea of saying it's another index that measures progress as such, right? So it measures the externalities also. It's a progress indicator, and that has, I think, like 200 different pieces to it. So it doesn't just measure economic progress, but also well-being and so on. But generally speaking, I think that these indicators are quite difficult to understand. For example, if you're looking at the fact that allegedly Switzerland is the happiest country in the world 3 years ago, and now it's Denmark or Sweden, I think. But a lot of people would not think that that is true about, you know, if they're from Denmark, they wouldn't say that they are the happiest, right? It's not always easy to understand why these indicators make any sense, but clearly GDP is basically sort of Stone Age calculation of the important factors.
And it's about measuring the wrong things. And so you move on to data. And I mean, this chapter is full of very strong morsels and quotes and memes. You move on to data and saying the more we pretend our data and the artificial intelligence that learns from it, the more we pretend our data is 100% complete in a truly human way, the more misguided the system's conclusions. I don't get that.
Yeah, it's not that easy to explain. I think ultimately the thing is about data is when you put garbage in, you get garbage out, right? And when you have a machine dealing with limited amount of information and disconnectivity and missing data, you will not get anything out that is anywhere close to what is going to be valuable enough. I think this is the problem, for example, when you're looking at artificial intelligence used in hospitals and so on. It's not that the AI is bad, it's just that it exists outside of an information system that's not complete. And that is biased. And, you know, stuff like, you know, what happened on LinkedIn advertising is that there's an AI making a placement, you know, there's an engine making the placement for the job announcement, and it would automatically assume that the data scientist cannot be a woman because it's looking at all of the data. Who's a data scientist on LinkedIn, and it's 99.8% are men. So it says, well, this is obviously not for women, so I'm not going to show the ad to women, right? And this happens everywhere now. These are all false negatives and misplaced assumptions. And, you know, this is all the kind of stuff where we have to worry about. Do we really want a machine doing that without really being you know, part of the larger debate about which way we're going with this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also mention Martin Seligman here in the book about his PERMA framework. Mm-hmm. So it's an acronym for pleasure, engagement, relationships, meaning, and accomplishments. Is that different? I think so, but is that different than Maslow's hierarchy? I think it's a different... is there a hierarchy in the PERMA framework?
No, I think it's just, you know, Seligman is trying to describe what makes us happy. He's written several books about this, right? Mm-hmm. There's a very simple recipe. It's obviously oversimplified in many ways, but it, like, for example, he says that 40% of what we are is just, we have our default happiness level that is somewhat genetic or brought into, you know, through the heretic line. The germ line, basically, which means that you're either disposed to be happy or less happy, and that's very true for a lot of people. And then there's 40% that you can change, but it's difficult. Right? And then there's voluntary action, the remaining 20%, where you can do with what you please. So how you can design happiness, and then he uses those five different things. You know, basically. Engagement, relationships, meaning, accomplishment, purpose—that is drivers of happiness, and that is something that I think I observe with many of my clients. That if they cover those areas, then generally they're feeling more happy.
Yeah, and you focus a lot here in this chapter on the relationship. Well, the relationship between relationships and being happy, and creating sense, purpose, and meaning. I mean, you even mentioned here the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. Who talks about relationship between happiness and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's. I mean, of course, this is a vast topic, you know, the happiness topic, yeah. Right? I think that if you put this all together, it's the subject definition of happiness is quite difficult, you know, because we all have different idea of what makes us happy and in which way it should go. I mean, there's so many quotes about this, you know, what people quote about what means happiness and what doesn't, and what you're pursuing and so on. And I think the main chapter part of the chapter in this book is to emphasize that I don't think that machines are much involved with our happiness. Mm-hmm. You know, they're accidental to this whole progress.
Really. Yes, you mentioned they cannot be compassionate. They don't have a sense of being.
Yeah, I mean, I say often in my speeches, say, you know, machines don't do relationships. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that really matters for humans is relationships, engagements, experiences. You know, ephemeral things. I mean, they're just as hard to define as happiness. I mean, how would you define a beautiful relationship? You know, you can do all these things and describe it, but in the end, it's a feeling. You know, it's not an equation. And machines are good with equation. And I think until we have quantum computing, which is probably coming in the next 5 to 10 years, where a machine can be both a zero and a one. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what quantum computing is possible of doing because it's 3D, right? It's a gas. It's not either or. It can actually be a zero and a one at the same time. Mm-hmm. And right now, that's not possible for machines. So that whole idea of having that part of what humans do all the time, and this is really what I think what we have to decide when we're looking at technology. Will it lead to happiness that's fake or orchestrated or essentially downloaded and engineered in some way, which isn't necessarily bad. It's just different, you know. Mm-hmm. Or will it cause us to look further, right, and to actually reach out for the things that will actually work for us?
I'm intrigued by what you just said about quantum computing. It's not zero and one. It's 3D. It's zero and one. So, in the book, you mentioned that. Machines are becoming good at simulating or human traits, but not really are like a human. So how would quantum computing, as you just described, as this being zero and one, could quantum computing change it? Can we go beyond simulating?
I think that That's an interesting question. I think, in theory, a computer that can do more than zeros and ones could have a more diversified approach to answers, you know? Mm-hmm. Because it could, in theory, do something like we are constantly doing, which is to readjust anything between zero and one. There's 1,000 combinations, and it all depends on the next answer, and we could change our mind, and it's completely, anything is possible at that moment. There's very few things for us that are zeros and ones as a hard fact, yeah? Mm-hmm. And in the computing universe, that means that your solution would be intractable, which means there's too many options, so the computer keeps cracking on, but nothing will happen. Mm-hmm. And humans do this all the time. You know, we decide that we like somebody or not. We don't look at the long list of facts and then say yes, no, maybe. We decide. Right? We are multinary, not binary. And if a computer can be multinary, which we may get there eventually, that in theory could mean that it would be able to take a lot more variations of opinion and therefore simulate even better what a human would be. That's probably not impossible.
Yeah, but could it then, or could technology or AI or technology in general, could it then have ethics? Because in the book you say technology has no ethics. It lives in the cloud of nihilism, a space without beliefs, but if we get there, would it be conceivable that technology has ethics?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you can define ethics as a rule, then we could define rules and then it could learn those rules or can simulate the rules, you know. But a belief or a value or a value judgment or imagination or a feeling that this is not right, mm-hmm. I think that I wouldn't say that's impossible for a machine, but I don't think that's a good idea for us to pursue that. And why would we? Because, you know, a computer being ultra intelligent with an IQ of a million, I don't want that computer to be emotional or anything. I want it to do the hard work. and let it do the hard work that we can't do because we don't have an IQ of a million. That is plenty of progress for all of humanity. I mean, we're going to go to other planets using this kind of technology, right? And so the thing is, for me, the answer to all those questions is usually not. I'm not convinced that it's not possible. I think it will be. I'm convinced that it's a very bad idea to pursue it.
And the more I'm reading your book and looking at your posts and getting immersed in your thinking, the question that keeps on popping up in my mind is why? So why is that a bad thing that technology would have ethics, would be able to have not only simulations but human traits? So you explain why you think you would like it to go, but why would it not be a good thing that it goes there?
I think the problem is that we are already at a stage to where we're anthropomorphizing a lot of technology. We're thinking of that as being quasi-human, right? And we're thinking of technology like a robot as her or him or and I think once we get technology that's too much like us, and then we feel that the computer has compassion. Mm-hmm. I think that's a dangerous place to go because we would very likely be utterly confused by this. And I think part of that is already that we're trusting machines more than humans, which is the strangest thing because most AI machines are as dumb as a toaster compared to humans. It's just that they seem better on the surface. You know, like when you're looking at TripAdvisor, which is essentially an AI in many ways, and telling you, you know, you're right in front of a great restaurant in London, you're looking inside, there's lots of happy people, you're reading the menu, but TripAdvisor says the place is terrible, go next door, which is empty, and you're still going to consider it. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine if that happens when we have machines that are cunning or I think that's, in terms of technology, I think we're far away from that because compassion, for example, requires a stance of consciousness and human agency. So you make a decision, as a bumper sticker says, to practice random acts of kindness. You know, this is something that you do despite the fact that it's illogical. To have compassion is a quite illogical undertaking by saying, are you going to waste your time doing something that is not for you? Or, you know, this is something that has to do with our inner landscape. And I think that is very difficult for a machine. If it was to simulate it, it would have trillions of possible combinations of responses. So I'm not sure that's a worthy undertaking. And why? Mm-hmm. Why would we do it? We would essentially cultivate our own competition.
Mm-hmm. I love the quote or the sentence or the meme in the book, quote, "I wonder if the nihilism of exponential technologies would be exponential as well."
Yeah.
And then you move into stewardship, which we will address in a couple of minutes.
Yeah. I'd be very concerned if this kind of thinking, like there is nothing special to humans, mm-hmm. or that there's nothing that we need to conserve because we have to transcend humanity. And this whole thinking about going beyond what is currently limiting us is extremely one-sided in the sense of not giving much points to value to what it is that makes us human, rather than saying, you know, we're not enough because we don't produce enough, or we're not fast enough, or we, you know, it's a completely sort of denial phase of anything that is really important to us humans, which has very little to do with what the technology does. And it's, again, the confusion between tool and purpose.
And who is going to set the norms? You call this stewardship of these technologies. You say, for example, it should not be put in the hands of military. I can follow you there to a great extent.
Yeah.
But it should not be put in the hands of technology developers, corporations, VCs, platforms. Why not?
You know, I think that... Well, you know, we're at the end of this period to where that really is an option anyway. But if your objective is to win a war or to have more power or to have more money, which ends up being the same thing, then I think you're going to use these technologies to our detriment because you can. You know, it's entirely possible. And this, again, is a Facebook problem, right? Facebook is using these technologies to their monetary benefit. And that is what it's designed to do, right? And if we allow the military to define, you know, how AI is being rolled out or not, you know, then we're in deep trouble because they don't really have larger goals except for maintaining power. And I mean, it's in a society like this, we have dozens of different angles. You know, we have intellectuals, we have religious leaders, we have scientists, we have politicians and so on. And everybody constructs the reality so that in the end, it's one picture, you know. Mm-hmm. If we were to take those larger issues, like what are we going to automate happiness and, you know, basically use a bot, for example, as a therapist, or, you know, have our kids' faces monitored as they do in China to see if they're actually paying attention at school or not. You know, those kind of things, like that is the idea of treating humans like machines.
Yeah, it's the first time since I know you that you articulated it so sharply, in the sense that if we let the platforms and so on do their thing, what they're playing, between quotes, is a finite game. And we should start playing, between quotes, infinite games, where it's not the purpose to win, but the purpose is to have an ongoing human well-being. So, and there is this quote in your book: "Human well-being should be the goal." So, I think that's the absolute essence of your book and this chapter. But it's the first time I hear you express it in a way of comparing finite and infinite games.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I mean, I think this short window of utter capitalism that we've had the last, you know, I don't know, 100 years, basically, in a nutshell, that window is closing because, you know, when technology is not far along, then these kind of principles of, you know, gains and consumption, they work fine. And because, you know, the worst possible damage you can do, and that we did do, is the environment. Yeah? But now we're going to damage us by using technology to simulate us, manipulate us, and then become like us, and then basically us becoming like them. Mm-hmm. You know, like Lewin says, at first we build things, and then we become them.
Yeah, that's the essence of your book. You don't want humans to become machines. That's yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's a fine line between saying, you know, becoming like a machine, like wearing a prosthesis after an accident or fixing a heart problem or so. You know, those are, some people argue, you know, machine-like features. But I'm talking about something completely different. The opting in, because we're searching for happiness, is to engineer the happiness in ourselves by, for example, wearing a virtual reality helmet and saying that you can be so happy there because all of your limitations are removed. You know, but that's completely disregarding the fact that we are actually becoming human by those very same limitations, where it takes effort to achieve something, or it takes a certain approach to achieving things. Yeah, and that approach is not the same for everyone. And this
is leading to the eudaimonic happiness that we mentioned in the beginning of this podcast.
Right. Yeah, I sometimes think, like, you know, and in the you know, just a decade ago, we used to call the cell phone companies mobile phone operators or mobile phone service providers, and now we're going to have sort of happiness providers, right? I mean, they're companies that say just use this and you'll be fine.
Well, there is one. I mean, there are many of them, and one of them is mentioned in your book. It's called Happify.com. Yeah. Well, what are they doing, Gert? In a nutshell.
In a nutshell, they're devising instruments and sort of healthcare well-being treatments that monitor your feeling and the way you feel about things and your sort of equilibrium. And then they help you with various technical solutions is to stay on a certain level of happiness.
So a sort of therapist.
Yeah, and there's dozens of those. You know, and I think this is a typical example of technology that's trying to get a wedge in between ourselves. So it's like, I always say, you know, selling technology is so much easier than selling humanity, because humanity is not something you can package. And so rather than us going out connecting to others and doing what really we need to be doing, we think we can buy a shortcut by putting down lots of money for a fancy gadget. You know? Mm-hmm. And this is very typical, of course, that we've always done that. But the question is like, you know, people are sitting in front of television looking for happiness, you know, to fight off their loneliness, and they
doesn't work.
They're getting more lonely. But and this is why, you know, we always use that. It's not new, but when we use it in such a complete way that technology will offer, you know, where it can go inside of a head in 10 years, it can go inside of a head, and then we're going to completely lose ourselves.
I mean, you mentioned in this very rich chapter mood bots, and happiness, hedonistic happiness generators. Wow.
I think, you know, this is all a little bit science fictiony, but it's not far away from.
No,
you know, like you have apps like Replica that replicate yourself in the case you die, then people can talk to you with the Replica app. You know? You have the WoBot, WeBot, which is a digital assistant you can use that will analyze and say, are you happy? This reminds me very much of the movie Her, right? Where you talk to the machine and she says, oh, you know, you feel unhappy. You know, can I? Yeah, sure. It's like, you know, who are we fooling with this? And so I think not necessarily. I mean, if you have an autistic child, you're using all kinds of means at your disposal to help the child figure out how to learn certain things and to get out of that miserable place that many parents are with their kids that have this, right? That's one thing. But if I'm going to use as a normal person a tool that makes me think like I'm having a real conversation, you know, that is, I mean, it's, I think it's funny, possibly, but it's, you know, that is a very, very strange thing to pursue. And I call that kind of stuff jerk tech. You
know? Jerk tech.
Jerk tech, you know, mm-hmm. that people jerking around people, basically. Mm-hmm. Technology that is basically, I don't know what reason they're pursuing with this, but I don't really see the human value.
Yeah. You mentioned just a couple of minutes ago decision of if something can be done, does it mean it should be done? And you illustrate that with some of the work or statements of Peter Diamandis from the Singularity University, which as you say in your book, you respect a lot. But sometimes he goes over the top, like we're going to have this eternal life and an extra 20, 30 years of healthy life. And in one of the recent blog posts that we co-authored together, we bumped into this difference between health span and lifespan. So the transhumanists, they talk about lifespan, eternal life. Mm-hmm. And Peter Diamandis seems, unless I'm wrong, please correct me, seems to talk about health span. Where are you in that quantum spectrum, if I can say so?
Yeah, I think that this whole debate about extending our lifespan and longevity is in principle not a bad discussion. I think that the idea of that being something that is primarily for rich people is quite clear, and that it's a product, it's also quite clear, and that many of the arguments for these Silicon Valley ventures like Human Longevity Inc., where it's also Peter's thing, I think, the argument is always dual-fold. Like, you know, we're going to solve a huge human problem here, and this will be amazing for people. And the flip side is, it'll make $4 trillion a year, you know, at maturity. And we happen to also be part of that.
Yeah, or it will result in civil unrest because there is inequality on who can access those technologies. Or
You know, Aristotle said, and if I get the translation right, he said, for all the virtues that will be present, when there's only one virtue, practical wisdom is that presence. And I think we need to go back to this and say, okay, if we're going to talk about practical wisdom, but it's about those things, what do we actually need here? And what do we want to do? And where do we have to make the difference between business and humanity? Because not everything that we do for technological reasons that we can do is going to further humanity. I mean, there's been plenty of examples where that would not. Yeah. It's just because it's progress. Yeah. I mean, of course, everybody wants to live longer and possibly forever. You know, everybody wants to be superhuman to some degree. But there's quite a few people that say, you know, what do I gain and what do I lose? That is, and I never hear that question from any of these guys. But what do we lose when we do this?
Yeah. You seem to have made a full circle, if I can put it that way, because you have done many, many, many presentations, engagements on this topic following your book. And if I look at your latest post from 15th of April, it's about practical wisdom, the master virtue. Mm-hmm. So you're coming full circle in the sense that you're coming back to the essence of your book.
Yeah. Also, I think that is part of, you know, I've been doing this for 15 years or 17 years, and I've done almost 2,000 engagements. And I realize, I think that the important part is, I mean, I love to philosophize on the larger scale with lots of people, but when it comes down to looking at the reason that people are there listening to me is, they have lots of practical issues. They have personal issues. They have larger questions. And it's a good thing to think about wisdom as important, but not in the sense of that being so far removed from their reality that they go away with lots of theory, right? It has to be practical. And if my practical approach is everything that we do needs to promote human flourishing, and human flourishing is not just more money, you know, there's a few more pieces to it, mm-hmm. you know, then, right. then this has consequences. And if we're going to build a way of genetically engineering people to live to be 120, then we damn well have to think about what it does to the social structure and who's got the left holding the bag and what do we lose. And yeah, if it can be done, we don't lose anything, then even better, right? But, you know, McLuhan said, you always, when you extend, you amputate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you use Tinder, do you amputate other things? It's kind of a funny
yes.
correlation. But do you amputate other things that you used to do that maybe are part of the effort? Yeah. I don't know. I don't use Tinder. I don't know. But I can imagine that, you know, when you use, we have to be very careful with this. When we do it too much, we amputate in too many places, then we tend to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. It would be a good exercise for one of your upcoming shows to have a, not a Tinder-like, but a slider type of metaphor where you show people what's the difference in choices between this side or the other side, like looking for real happiness or hedonistic happiness.
And you know, I think this is that the challenge is that for a lot of human context that we're talking about, it's the question of pursuing happiness is always underneath, but it's in many cases not an aware activity. You know? Yeah. And it is something that you know you don't feel entirely happy, and but you know, it's, I think technology is very, very tempting at covering that. You know? So it says, there's no boredom because you can always play a game on your mobile phone, or you can always look for the next airplane out. If you live in London, you can always fly to Ibiza for £20. And technology always has the solutions that we can cover the fact that we haven't been happy. It doesn't put the finger on it and says, you know what, no matter how many flights you've taken, you're not actually achieving anything here with this, And that only happens to very few people, where all of a sudden they have this realization that this is just kind of on a very much a top level. And again, this is where the movie Her is really a great movie about this. Realize that person is really unhappy in the end, right? He's a very unhappy guy. And he feels so happy because the machine is covering it all up. Until it falls apart. So I think this is something that is crucial to our realization as to how far do we want to go with technology, embrace technology, but don't become it, as I'd like to say.
Yeah. And one way to not control that, but guide all that is probably what is covered in the next chapter of your book.
Yeah, so we'll go to that next week, and then we have a few more chapters to go, and then this podcast will continue for some timely related topics having to do with topics in this book, but we're going to continue doing this. I know there's millions of you listening out there, so that's definitely a good thing.
Great.
All right, thanks, Peter. So you want to find out more about Peter, it's at Peter Van on Twitter, Peter Van like the van, V-A-N, and I'm G Leonhard, G-L-E-O-N-H-A-R-D. And the book is at techvshuman.com. Lots and lots of videos on GERTube, which is my YouTube channel, all on these topics. The book is now available in 11 languages. Just last week, it came out in Chinese.
Wow.
So you buy lots of books, That's definitely a good idea. So thanks for tuning in, and I hope to see you down the road. And thanks for being on the show, Peter.
Yes, have a great spring.
Okay. Bye. Bye.